This is Life and Art from FT Weekend. I'm Lila Raptopoulos. Chef Fadi Katan has been called the voice of modern Palestinian cuisine. He was born and grew up in Bethlehem. He studied in Paris. He lived in London. And in 2015, Fadi did something that really wasn't done in the West Bank. He opened a locally sourced fine dining restaurant in Bethlehem that specialized in Palestinian food. It's called Fouda. When Fouda opened, people called Fadi crazy because despite the restrictions that Israel had placed on the territory, he insisted on doing things right. He traveled through checkpoints to get the best salt from the Dead Sea. He brought tablecloths from abroad because he couldn't get them in Palestine. And he did it because, to him, this mattered. For years now, Fadi has also been documenting the dishes that he grew up eating because he's proud of the Palestinian cooking tradition and he wants it to have a future. Last year, Fadi opened a Palestinian restaurant in London, and this month he's coming out with a beautiful new cookbook. It is called Bethlehem, A Celebration of Palestinian Food. He's speaking with me today from Bethlehem, just 60-odd miles away from the closest entry to Gaza. Fadi, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you. I wonder, to start, if you could tell me a little bit about where you're talking to me from. Are you at home?
I'm at home in Bethlehem. I'm lucky to live in my great-grandfather's home.
Wow.
So basically every stone around us is from 1886. I'm 1,500 meters away from the Church of the Nativity, mm-hmm. and I'm literally less than minutes walk from the market, from the souk. So I'm very grateful and feel very privileged to be where I am, despite what's happening in Gaza, despite what's happening in the West Bank.
Can I ask what things in Bethlehem have been like since the war on Gaza began in October, just to give listeners a sense?
It's been insane. So when the war started, I'm not sure I actually used the word. I don't even know how to call it. So that's the essence of it is, I don't know how to call it. Is it a war? Is it an attack? Is it a genocide? But in Bethlehem, basically, we were put very quickly under lockdown. So we couldn't leave the city for the first few weeks. The Israeli army closed down all accesses to the city. Then they reopened. So we can move in the West Bank. We can't really move towards Jerusalem, for example.
Right.
It's tense. It's extremely tense. It's, you know, one of my nightmares every evening when I sit outside, I hear the planes flying over going to Gaza. And I wonder, are they going to bomb somebody I know? The reality of Bethlehem right now is also, Bethlehem's a touristic city.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
Since the Gaza attack, or hotels have closed down, so you have around 9,000 people that have lost their job for 8 months now. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole load of people who used to work inside Israel who are no more allowed back inside Israel by the Israeli authorities. So Bethlehem's like very much on the edge of being impoverished. And then, of course, there's the common fear, which I have, which a lot of people have. Are we next? Is the West Bank coming next after Gaza?
Right. You know, Fadi, I only learned recently, maybe I should have known, but that in Bethlehem, there's a humongous wall going through it.
Yeah. There's a 12-meter high wall.
Yeah.
That wall is not even built on the internationally recognized border between Palestine and Israel. It is actually built inside Bethlehem.
Right.
I'm not a fan of that wall being fetishized because it's sadly it has become fetishized with a lot of artwork. I think it should be just this ugly gray concrete structure that we all hope we get rid of, because it's not only walling Palestinians inside Palestine, it's also making sure that every generation of new Israelis do not know what the Palestinians of the West Bank are.
Right.
And it allows this total brainwashing of the other is the boogeyman. It's true I'm bearded and whatever, but I'm a cool guy. I do use knives for work, but I don't stab human beings. Like, come on, really?
Yeah.
You know, and that whole voluntary lack of knowledge, that whole dehumanizing, the wall is part of it.
Right. Well, on that note, I would love to talk about your cookbook, which is brand new and stunning. It's a very beautiful object. As a cookbook to cook from, it's a beautiful experience. But I wanted to ask first about the journey, because to me, the book represents like this big project of yours, which is kind of to document and to communicate Palestinian culture using food. Can you tell me a little bit about how that project started, how that, where that desire started from?
It started when I was a kid in my grandmother's kitchen. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, my Teta Julia, is a woman who was one of the co-founders of something called the Arab Women's Union, which is a cultural social center in Bethlehem.
Yeah.
She started the first museum in Bethlehem with her colleagues at the Arab Women's Union.
Wow.
And so the whole idea of documenting, archiving, preserving, and transmitting, because I was on the receiving end of transmission. So I was that little kid that was being shown old pictures, old documents, old recipes. I remember one of my worst recipes ever that I totally burned was as a kid being taken to her garden where she had what in my imagination today looks like a sorcerer's cauldron. we were supposed to do a fruit jam, and I had this massive wooden spoon that again, in my imagination, feels like it was 10 times my size,
right.
And I burned the jam. And the great thing was that adaptability, because she just smiled at me and said, oh, we're doing pet de fruits, no more jam. And we poured that overcooked jam into trays, let it dry, cut it into cubes, and pretended for the rest of the family that we actually did fruit candy. But
on purpose.
You know, that is really where that desire to document, to share, but it's document and share something that is still alive.
Yes. It's documenting the history, but also letting it adapt. That sounds like a common theme in everything you're doing.
You know, I don't believe in dogma. So you mentioned earlier when I started Fauda, people said I was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy being called crazy. I don't have a problem with that. True, you know, when I showed up in Bethlehem with a... where it started...
Yeah, tell me about that. Tell me what that was like, opening the restaurant in Bethlehem. Can you give listeners a taste of what that's like?
I'll give you a very simple example. Bethlehem and Palestine don't have fine dining restaurants.
Right.
And I wanted to do my fine dining obsession. Not only fine dining, but I was sourcing local and I didn't have a menu. So basically every morning I'd go to the market, whatever those fantastic artisans and farmers had would make up my menu of the day. The menu was very eclectic. I mean, I would go to Ibn Nabil and be like, oh, so what herbs do we have today? And she'd smile at me like, well, you know what? I don't have much mint, but I do have one bunch of mint. And I'd take the bunch of mint, even if I knew we had 60 covers that night.
Right.
And mint would end up being one leaf of mint in a plate somewhere.
Yeah. And this woman that you're speaking about is in the book. She's an incredible, she seemed like an incredible woman that you grew up going to.
She's fantastic.
She sort of runs a stall at the market.
Yeah. She runs a stall at the market. She's been there for 45 years.
Mm-hmm.
She knows my great aunts and grandmothers and grandfathers. And that's the beauty of Bethlehem. It's a village. I mean, it is a city, but it's actually a big village.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing where people thought I was crazy is, you know, in a lot of countries that are away from the Eurocentric vision of food, replicating European food seems to be the mark of quality.
Right.
But the same applies to wines.
Right.
And I never had a foreign wine on my wine list in Bethlehem. I only had Palestinian wines.
Mm-hmm.
So I think challenging people's conceptions is very important.
Yeah. Let's talk about the book. To decide what to cook, I was drawn to some of the recipes because they're very similar to the recipes that I grew up with and cook often. As I told you before we started, I'm Armenian and Greek, and my family's from Anatolia originally. And so I saw your kefta wrapped in grape leaves, which is your mother's recipe, and they looked a lot like Smyrna keftedakia. They looked like Armenian dolma. And so I decided to make it, and I decided to stick very closely to your recipe. Like, make the meatballs with allspice, cinnamon, nutmeg, cardamom, mm-hmm. parsley, you know, tuck the balls into grape leaves, surround them with sliced tomato. And it was so delicious. And it had the same kind of warmth and soul that my family's version of these dishes have. Mm-hmm. It sort of like reaches a place of longing in me a little bit. But it told a different story. It kind of was clearly your culture story. Mm-hmm. And I found that very moving, that like you had the small difference of adding cardamom and like wrapping them as round balls and not like ovals. And like just those small things can really bring you to a different place.
You know, we were all ruled for 400 years by the Ottomans.
Yeah.
And cuisine traveled like it travels in any empire. Mm-hmm. But each terroir, and when I say terroir, it englobes all elements of the terroir, whether it's the land, the produce, but also the people and the tradition. Mm-hmm. All terroirs do overcome and give their own identity.
Right.
You know, the Armenian community is very present in Palestine, in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, because when they fled the genocide, they came to seek refuge here.
Yes.
And I'm very close to the community. I have friends in the community. I have family members in the community. And we always tease each other about that difference that you felt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And where in the Armenian community in Jerusalem, it would be more nostalgic longing for what their grandparents and great-grandparents have lost.
Yeah.
While for us, it's a celebration of something that's still alive, but that's being threatened of disappearing.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. Fadi, because there are so many similarities with other cuisines in this region, can you tell us what Palestinian food is exactly? Like, what makes it distinct?
Palestinian food, to make it very easy, is the food that is inspired by the terroirs of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
The terroirs of Palestine, to simplify it, are the coast, Mediterranean coast. That's where in Gaza you'll have a lot of fish, you'll have a lot of dill, you'll have chili in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
You know why we have chili in Gaza? It's because historically, chili came from India. Gaza was one of the largest ports in the Mediterranean.
Mm.
So it came to Gaza and was shipped on boats to Europe.
Right.
It wasn't shipped out of Jaffa or Haifa, which were the other two ports. And that's why more north on the coast, you don't have a chili tradition.
Yes.
Then you have the inland of Palestine, which is the almond, fig, olive tree landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the desert, which is the Bedouin nomadic traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Give you an example. We do a dish called feta, or mansaf, depending on which region you are in the country.
Right, that's a lamb shank dish.
Mm-hmm. If you're in Bethlehem, you will use that dried yogurt that is from the Bedouin tradition called laban jamid.
Mm-hmm.
You rehydrate it and you soak the rice and bread with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you cook your lamb in it.
Right.
If you're in Gaza, you don't use laban jamid because Gaza, the coast, did not have sheep grazing in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go up north towards Nablus and further up to Nazareth, where they have green pastures,
mm-hmm.
they never preserved the yogurt. So you were cooking it with a fresh goat yogurt.
Right. That's so interesting.
They're the same dish, but they're three different dishes.
Yes.
That is Palestinian cuisine. I can go into the generalities of saying Palestinian cuisine is za'atar, sumac, olive oil, and laban jamin. And that is where people make the mistake of saying, well, it's similar to Lebanese, Syrian, and Jordanian cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
We also have commonalities, definitely.
Right.
But we have that very distinct kitchen.
Yes. Very specific to the land.
Mm-hmm. So those were the things people don't know. The other thing that people don't know, and that's where the drink side of things, but also in the book, there's a pork recipe, for example.
Yes, I was going to ask you, the roasted pork leg.
People don't know that we're very diverse people.
Right.
So what we have to remind people is prior to 1948, and from the Roman period, so the first time this bit of the world was called Palestina, under the Roman rule, so 50 years ago, 2,100 years ago, the inhabitants of this land were Palestinians. It's just you live in the region called Palestine, you're Palestinian, mm-hmm. Whatever your faith was. Mm-hmm. And that is what people don't know. So the book will challenge this, of course, but I love the fact that my mother is blonde, for example. It's just like she is a blonde. And I think it'll like unsettle half of the people that don't know much about Palestine.
Right.
Because in their preconception, Layla, you look more like what they'd expect a Palestinian to look like.
Right.
Because your hair is a bit darker than my mother's. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important because, again, it comes back to what we're saying about humanity.
In a new series of Tectonic from the Financial Times, we go to the front lines of China's rise as a tech superpower. From the factories of Shenzhen, China's Silicon Valley, to Nigeria, where Chinese phones dominate.
Oppo, Vivo.
And Germany, where Chinese electric vehicles may overtake the big car makers. Subscribe to Tectonic wherever you get your podcasts.
So Fadi, as we get toward the end of our conversation, I really want to place us again in the current moment. Since Hamas's October 7th attacks on Israel and Israel's invasion of Gaza, it's just been a nightmare. The Gazan authorities estimate that nearly 35,000 people have been killed. People in Gaza have very limited access to food. There's threat of famine. And I think, you know, some people might say, why talk about Palestinian food and culture right now while people are starving? But it makes sense to me that this is actually extremely important to do now. And I'm curious what you hope people take away from your book that could help them contextualize what's going on.
So it's 2 million Palestinians being starved. They're not starving. Mm-hmm. They're being starved. They're being starved. We all heard it on our news channels in the, mm-hmm. just after the 7th of October, where the Israeli government officials clearly said, we will not allow food, water, and energy into Gaza. Mm. That should scare all of us because that sends you back to the Middle Ages where people lay siege mm-hmm. to fortresses. Mm-hmm. I couldn't cook for the first few weeks after the 7th of October. I couldn't bring myself to, you know, actually exercise cooking while I had family and friends in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that we made a grave mistake in 1948 when our lands were dispossessed. We concentrated on trying to rebuild our lives. And I'm not a refugee, but you know, I'm talking collectively as Palestinians. We were dealing with the consequences of having 52% of our land being dispossessed, and we did not focus on things like food. Mm. What it leads to is what we're seeing today, which is a total appropriation of our cuisine by Israeli chefs mm-hmm. who label it and claim it's Israeli. Mm. I think it's very important, whatever cuisine it is, to celebrate its origin. So I started writing the book 2.5 years ago. It went to print before the 7th of October. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, it's not coming out now because of what's happening.
Right.
But it's true that it's very confusing having this book come out now. But in reality, I think it's important to, you know, have people take that journey with the book mm-hmm. and actually find out more about who are those Palestinians? Mm. What is the cuisine of those Palestinians? Mm-hmm. My dream would be that one day, diners, wherever they are in the world, will, when they're asking themselves, should we go have Italian or Sichuanese cuisine tonight, also be like, oh, should we go have Palestinian food tonight?
Right.
Because that means our culture is still alive.
Right, right. My last question for you, Fadi, and thank you so much for your time, is just for the next months, I'm curious what your sort of hopes and plans are for yourself and for the restaurant and for Palestine.
I'll start from myself. For myself, I've embarked on a few different projects. For the restaurant in London, I just hope it goes on being.
Right.
for Palestine?
Before you start this.
Yeah, that's a difficult one.
We have behind us, is that the call to prayer behind you?
Oh, yeah, it is.
Okay, it is. Just for listeners to know, that's the call to prayer.
Exactly, this is Bethlehem. For Palestine, I hope that first that things stop immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Because you mentioned 35,000 people have been killed by the Israeli occupation. That has to stop, because the years it will take to just deal with the fact that 80% of Gaza's homes have been demolished, the fact that there's hundreds of thousands of injured people, that by itself is just a drama beyond any capacity of some international aid agency that'll clap their fingers and get it sorted. It'll be years and years and years to try and get livelihood in Gaza back, just to start livelihood. But my real hope is, I used to believe in two states.
Mm.
And maybe it was the time where I was trying to be pragmatic and abandon my utopian side. And now I'm back to my utopian side of, why can't we just live based on justice?
Mm.
So repairing the wrongs that have been done, i.e. giving me back my orange grove in Jaffa, i.e. allowing the millions of Palestinian refugees back home, but also living side by side together as citizens of one state where we're equal. Just like in the United States, you are American.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of your ethnic or religious background, why can't we aspire to that?
Mm.
My dream, based on this, is for people to be able to live free and equal.
Mm.
And every moment that this whole insanity goes forward, I'm scared that dream will disappear. We worked very hard. And when I say we, I englobe myself in some left philosophy of the world. We worked very hard to allow people to have free choice of abortion.
Right.
We've worked very hard to allow farmers to choose going down the organic routes. And that's what we should be doing for Palestine.
Yeah, yeah. Fadi, I'll say to listeners, Bethlehem is published on May 14th in the U.S., and May 16th in the UK. Fadi, I will remember this conversation for a long time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being
here. Thank you, Leila. Thank you very much.
That's the show. Thank you for listening to Life and Art from FT Weekend. We've put links to stories about Fadi's cooking in the show notes, along with places to find him on social media. Every link that brings you to the Financial Times gets you past the paywall. Also in the show notes are ways to stay in touch with me and with the show on email and on Instagram. I'm Lila Raptopoulos, and here is my brilliant team. Katya Kumkova is our senior producer. Lulu Smith is our producer. Our sound engineers are Breen Turner and Sam Javinko, with original music by Metaphor Music. Topher Forges is our executive producer, and our global head of audio is Cheryl Brumley. Have a lovely week, and we'll find each other again on Friday.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. From a local business to a global corporation,
partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful you'll make every move matter.
Visit bankofamerica.com/banking for business to learn more.
What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.